in connection with what's happened here in the Passover. So, chapter 13, verses 1 to 10.
Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Sanctify to me every firstborn, the firstborn offering of every womb of the sons of Israel, both of man and beast, that belong to me." Moses said to the people, "Remember this day in which you went out from Egypt from the house of slavery, for by a powerful hand the Lord brought you out from this place, and nothing leavened shall be eaten. On this day, in the month of Abib, you are about to go forth. It shall be when the Lord brings to you the land of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, Hivite, Jebusite, which he swore to your father to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall observe this rite in this month. For 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there shall be a feast to the Lord. Unleavened bread shall be eaten throughout the 7 days, and nothing leavened shall be seen among you, nor shall any leaven be seen among you in all your borders. You shall tell your son on that day, saying, 'It is because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt.' And it shall serve as a sign to you on your hand, and as a reminder on your forehead, that the law of the Lord may be in your mind, for the powerful hand of the Lord brought you out of Egypt. Therefore, you shall keep this ordinance at its appointed time from year to year."
All right. It may help to just say one word about the structure of this chapter so we can kind of keep track of what's going on. What he does is he mentions the redemption of the firstborn in verses 1 and 2, and then we actually have instructions as far as the feast of unleavened bread in 3 to 10, and then we come back to the instructions relating to the redemption of the firstborn in 11 to 16. I'm not going to belabor this. You can work this out on your own. But what you will see, particularly in like 5 through 9, and I forget exactly what verse is here in the firstborn, is you will see parallel structure, point by point, in these two sections. So you can look for that. But what he says about the keeping of the feast of unleavened bread is that when the Lord brings them into the land, that they are to observe the feast of unleavened bread in the first month, not eat any leaven. And again in verse 8, "You shall tell your son on that day." Now, this is the instruction for when they come into the land. What are they supposed to tell their son? Yeah, but what are they to tell their son?
"The Lord brought me out of Egypt."
What do you see in that? Do you see what I see, Roger?
It's kind of personalized, like what God did for me.
Yes! When they come into the land, is it the people who come into the land that the Lord brought out of Egypt? And yet they are to speak of it as if it happened to them. They are to identify themselves with what the Lord did in bringing them out of Egypt. "You tell your son it's because of what the Lord did for me when I came out of Egypt." We are to always see these events of God as living events that we have a personal share in. We see this as what God has done for me. He brought me out of Egypt. Now, not literally that I was in Egypt, but we are the benefactors. We're the ones who receive the blessing of being brought out of Egypt. Otherwise, we'd be there too. So I think that's interesting. And they are to observe this on an annual basis, verse 10. Not to be postponed, rescheduled, whatever. Every year, they observe this feast of unleavened bread. Comments and questions? Yes?
Yeah. Maybe a little love of the Lord and what he works at. He does one thing. He does expect us as a floor to remember that and to go back to that. I think often we try to make God be our servant, do things for us continually. And if two salvations, this salvation here is our salvation. And those are the two things that he did. And we always go back to that. We don't require more than that. We don't deserve more than that. And God expects us without, you know, further acts, without even further miracles, without even further proof, just love and appreciate that, and that's it. We need to be happy. with just that.
Yeah, because just that is amazing. Yes, exactly. Bill?
Were they only allowed to eat their unleavened bread during this 1 week of the year? But did they have it whenever they wanted to, but during this specific week they had to have it?
Yes, I think they could have it whenever they wanted to, but for most people, leavened bread is the preferred choice. Yeah. Misty?
Were they supposed to take this to Passover in the wilderness?
That's a good question. In Joshua 5, the question is, did they partake of the Passover in the wilderness? I know in Joshua 5 and verse 10, when they camped in Gilgal, they observed the Passover. I am not so sure they observed the Passover in the wilderness. Am I right, Joe?
No, they hadn't been circumcised during all that time. So
good point. Yeah. So I think they started the Passover in Joshua 5.
Numbers chapter 9. Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the wilderness of Sinai in the first month of the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt, saying, let the children of Israel keep the Passover.
So they did in that second year. Good point.
Yeah. While they were in the Egypt.
Yeah. So that, maybe that's the way we ought to look at that. I mean, they did at least for a short time, but it looks to me like the fact that they weren't circumcised would mean they couldn't have partaken of it as an uncircumcised person. Anybody got any more information? Dave?
Time frame between Numbers 9 and the time of Joshua, you have their faithlessness in going into the land, and so that generation is destroyed. The one that's uncircumcised is the next generation.
Good point. Yes, that is exactly right. Numbers 14 comes after Numbers 9, so perhaps that's when they sort of suspended it. Roger?
I have no question.
Well, anybody else got a point on this question? Jonathan? I get too many at once.
Was it chapter 4? So Moses was out there killed during the circumcised. So I think that during the time of the wilderness after they rebelled before going into the land, they weren't permitted after them to be circumcised. It was just showing the debts that God was wanting to associate with them to a degree.
Maybe that's it. I've wondered if they just neglected it, but I don't know. Anybody else on this point? Eric?
Is it Amos kind of talks about, talks about how the, raises the question, did you even give sacrifices to me in the wilderness?
Yeah, Amos 5, 25 to 27, good point. Some of these questions, I'll tell you, you start studying the Old Testament and, you know, overall, while I've worked on Exodus a good bit recently, the law is probably my weakest part of the Old Testament, and you realize how many things you don't know, how many questions you haven't even thought about. So it's helpful to have several good students in here, and always feel free to correct me. I need that from time to time. So, all right, are we ready for Roger's question? All right, Roger, ask me a simple one, all right?
The instruction, he just starts out the instruction of the firstborn and says, hey, by the way, you talk to me about the Passover again, and then he'll come back to the instruction of the firstborn.
Yeah.
So, is there like a connection between the Passover and the firstborn? That's what he's trying to do.
Well, he certainly describes it in parallel language. That's, you know, he starts by saying when the Lord brings you, then he gives the instructions, then he tells what to say to your son. Then he says, with a powerful hand, the Lord brought you out of Egypt. And then he has the sign on your hand and on your forehead. So he deals with them in parallel fashion. I'm not sure I know what to say about that, but it's interesting that he does. So he seems to see some connection. Michael.
Was part of that they owed their firstborn because of what he
meant? Well, exactly. Both of these are connected with the Exodus. The firstborn belongs to God because he spared their firstborn. The unleavened bread is a part of the Exodus as well. Dave.
He gets into more the relationship to the redemption of the firstborn things in Numbers 3.
Yes. Yeah, we have, there's more instructions on almost all of these things throughout the rest of the law, particularly Numbers, and that's That's something I've got to work on more. Numbers is probably one of my weakest Old Testament books, so I got a lot more to learn. So we'll just take this a step at a time. But thank you. Other observations? All right. How about 11 to 16, and get this part with the redemption of the firstborn as well. 11 to 16.
When the Lord brings you into the land of the Canaanites, as he swore to you and your fathers, and shall give it to you, you shall set apart to the Lord all that first opens the womb, all the firstborn of your animals, though the male shall be the Lord's. Every firstborn of a donkey shall redeem with the land, or you will not redeem it, you shall break its neck. Every firstborn of man among your sons you shall redeem. And when in time to come your sons ask you, what does this mean? You shall say to him, by a strong hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt, from the house of slavery. For when Pharaoh stubbornly refused to let us go, the Lord killed all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of animals. Therefore I sacrifice to the Lord all the males that first opened the womb, but all the firstborn of my sons I redeem. It shall be as a mark on your hand, or frontlets between your eyes, for by a strong hand the Lord brought us out of Egypt.
So, this firstborn idea, you've got the fact that God spared the firstborn of the Israelites because of the blood. That means both the firstborn people, you know, the firstborn in the families, and also the firstborn animals. Because God killed both the firstborn of the humans and the animals of the Egyptians. So, God has a special claim on these firstborn ones. He didn't have to spare them, but he chose to. Now, that says the firstborn are mine. Now, they would have been God's anyway. God always has the first of everything, but they have a special reason now that the firstborn man and animals belong to God. Now, what does that mean? Well, it can mean this. What if it was the firstborn lamb? What were you supposed to do? Sacrifice. That's your way of giving the firstborn to God. So if it's the firstborn of a sacrificially acceptable animal, you sacrifice and give it to God. What if it's the firstborn human or the firstborn donkey? Would God want the human sacrifice? No, obviously not. God is against child sacrifice. Would he want the donkey sacrificed? Also, no, for a slightly different reason, donkeys weren't sacrificially appropriate animals. So what do you do in that case? Well, in both cases, they must be redeemed. If they can't be sacrificed, then they're redeemed. The firstborn person with the payment of money, and with the donkey, the sacrifice of a lamb in its place. You've got, man, there's so many passages that deal with this, but you have some of that in Luke chapter 2 with Jesus. He was the firstborn, and so they presented him to the Lord in the temple in Luke chapter 2, 22 and 23, because he was considered as the firstborn belonging to the Lord. If you didn't want to sacrifice a lamb in place of the donkey, then you destroyed the donkey. And if we're not redeemed for the Lord, we're destroyed as well. So basically, human and donkey fit in about the same category. And the lambs and goats and so forth would be sacrificed. That's the basic idea. You've also got this idea here. If the son asks you, children want to learn the meaning of what these things are. You know, why do we do this? And you're supposed to explain that to him. And what are you supposed to explain? With a powerful hand, the Lord brought us out of Egypt from the house of slavery. You haven't explained, that's one of the rules that we got at our synagogue, you know, at our temple. Our temple says we have to pay, you know, this, we have to do this, and all that. This is the rule. This is how you do it. No, they don't want to know how you do it. They've been seeing how you do it for a long time. They want to know why you're doing it. And so you go back and you show them what God did as he brought us out of Egypt. Comments and questions on that? Roger.
Yeah, I mean, God is interested in these people remembering this. I mean, he's doing all this stuff with the herds and, like, I mean, he wants them for this stuff to stick in their mind.
Why does he want them to remember this?
Because if they don't, then they're going to fall away. And that's what you see in their history.
But why does he want them to remember this?
It's Christ.
Yeah, he wants them to remember him. He wants them to remember what he has done. We're not just remembering this because he wants them to know history. You know, it's great to learn history. No, no. He wants them to remember him and the great things he has done. Remembering these events leads us to remember the Lord. And I think the thing that we see so much in everything we've seen in Exodus so far, who's the main character of Exodus? Yeah. What's the focus? God. And this is a book that teaches us about the Lord and leads us to really admire and appreciate the Lord. If we're not teaching our children the Lord, we're leaving out the main part. And that's the part that it seems like we never get around to teaching. We'd rather teach them rules than the Lord. It's kind of like, we do this too. Obviously, I'm not talking to too many parents, but a lot of you will be. We do this too. It's like sometimes we want to mostly teach them the rules to get them to behave. We mostly want to figure out ways to get them to mind instead of teaching them the principles that will enable them to rule themselves later on. Now, when they're small, we've got to discipline them and we've got to teach them to behave. But the purpose is not just behavior modification so they don't create a pain for us. The purpose is to train them to discipline themselves. So the purpose of teaching these things is to teach them about the Lord, not just to get them to know the rules and get them to follow the rules. Understanding those points, I think, really helps us in raising our children properly. Dad.
And learning about the Lord is so helpful for us. You know, we look at the book of Exodus, we learn about all these rituals and all these things, the sacrifice and the Passover, and we can say, well, what can I do? How does this affect me? Well, just knowing the Lord, knowing God, tells us and teaches us how we should be in response. I'm amazed in Peter's sermon in Acts chapter 2. He just talks about Jesus. He says about who he is, how he's been prophesied, the type of life he lived. And the end result that people said is, what shall we do? And so the knowledge of Christ and the knowledge of God produces action and produces a change in us as well.
Yeah, exactly. We are so focused sometimes on we just want to know what to do. We don't want to know the Lord. That is not the right thing. I hear sometimes people talking about, well, I just don't like learning the Old Testament. That's not for us. Well, why is there anything about God that's not for us?
Amen.
Now, I understand we're not supposed to observe the Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. These are not our rules. But everything about God is for us, and we ought to have a great desire to learn it and know it. Carl.
Just encouragement along those lines. I've had occasion, two congregations I've been with, to study the very profound book of Leviticus. People are amazed when they get in there that it's not just all these boring rules that you're learning about God's character, you're learning about holiness specifically, and people come away so encouraged from a study of Leviticus when they thought going in, oh, can't believe I'm going to have to read Leviticus. And that mindset is just amazing to me. How'd you come out so fulfilled?
Yeah, that's been my experience too. We did Leviticus in these year-end studies years ago, and it's probably been the most popular thing we did. Joe did it at the Indiana Leadership Camp for a few of the kids, and every one of the kids, I think, that had that class just was raving about that and not about the other classes. It's amazing how much there is to learn in Leviticus. Maybe it was just because of Joe. I don't know. At least people raving. But Roger.
I imagine if God would have done this differently, and instead of doing the 10 plagues first, he would have done the law and given them the law. I mean, they disobeyed it no matter what. But I mean, it would have been nothing to them. Why obey God? Why do all these things if God would have shown them his power and his wisdom and his mind? I mean, God did it this way. for a reason. I mean, he showed him who he was, how powerful he was, how wise he was. And then he says, I want you to do all these things. And that's why the people say, yes, I'll do whatever you tell me because you're powerful and mighty. And I think we need to comprehend that. God is powerful, God is mighty. That's why we obey what it says. We get it backwards. We're never, ever going to do what he said with a true heart and with a true commitment.
Amen. Great point, yes. JD.
Just to add to what Roger said, first the plagues and then the mercy of Passover and then the law.
Yes. Excellent. Andrew?
You really had a good point earlier about like parents wanting to like just like tell the rules like, oh, God says this. Like today, really good point is that like us Christians, we need to go out to the world and teach them about Christ, you know. And the point is that we aren't out there like, okay, God told us to do this. Hey, I've heard about Jesus Christ. You try and get to love because you can't. You can't. They have to do it themselves. They have to love God, Jesus. You can't make them love Jesus and God. You can't do the assignment for them. God doesn't want you to foreplay for them to obey God. Themselves have to do it and decide themselves if they really want to obey God and love Him.
Sure. And teaching about the Lord is the thing that motivates us to want to love and obey God. Michael.
I don't know. This would have affected different people in different ways, people with big flocks or people just starting out. But you think about however many people were just starting out with, you know, a couple of goats and or a couple of cows or something, and that it would have really been a sacrifice for them. And I don't know, again, how that compares to us, but maybe, you know, think about what if your first job, you had to give all your first month's pay or your first year's pay to the Lord. And what sacrifice that meant should have let them know what God had done for them, what the returning.
Good point. Yes. Very good. All right. 17 to the end of the chapter. 22, I think. Yeah.
The Pharaoh let the people go. God did not keep them by the way of the land of the Philistines, although that was near. For God said, lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. But God led the people around by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea. The people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt equipped for battle. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for Joseph had made the sons of Israel solemnly swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones with you from here. And they moved on from Succoth and camped at Ephraim, on the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of cloud to lead them along the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, that they might travel by day and by night. The pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night did not depart from the people.
Okay, this just sort of finalizes the Exodus now. God leads them out, not along the coast because they'd have to fight the Philistines and might change their mind and want to go back to Egypt, but he leads them toward the Red Sea. They're carrying the bones of Joseph, just like Joseph had said hundreds of years before. He knew they'd go out because of God's promise into the promised land. He wanted them to take his bones and bury them in the promised land, and God was leading them with the cloud and with the fire, leading them through the wilderness right toward the Red Sea. Comments and questions?
Well, just to note that what Hebrews, the emphasis Hebrews puts on Joseph's act of saying, bring my bones out, the faith he has in God, the promise that he would eventually, there would be an Exodus.
Yes. Very good. Chris?
Also, the idea that God's offering something for free and is providing a way for us to get that, and then goes to all the trouble to make sure he doesn't put any obstacles in the way. You know, he's the one that's redeeming us, and we're the one that needs it, but he says, here it is, but here, come around this way. It's easier to get there than going through the Philistines and having to battle them. He's made all the provisions and done everything and still adds ways to make it easier.
Exactly. He's amazing. So helpful and so concerned for them when, you know, you think he should have just said, well, I've done this, now it's up to you. Yeah, Tim.
And yet they still complain. I'm sure we do.
Exactly. Michael.
The pillar of cloud and the
pillar of fire. I never thought a whole lot about that until a few months ago. I saw a video on the internet, I think it was in Brazil, where a tornado passed through brush fires or something, and the fire just got sucked up in the, and it was like the tornado was on fire.
Wow.
And it's a picture I can't get out of my head now that I think about this. It's really cool to think that something like that maybe is what they were looking at here, and how impressive that was supposed to still be to the people who aren't sure exactly.
That's interesting. Yeah, I thought about that. All right. Jody.
This might be a question, I don't know, but, you know, a lot of times they didn't have, like, this was written after it all happened and everything. Did Rip C get its name used by what happened in it?
I think it was associated with, like, the weeds that were in it, I think is the idea. Yes.
I've heard it said that a little fire at night, you know, the desert's cold, so keep them warm, and then the clouds to keep them from like shade them because it's hot. Is there anything to that, or is that just?
Not that I know of. I'm not assuming that the fire engulfed them or the clouds. You know, just kind of leading them. I don't know. All right. Well, let's take a break. And in a few minutes, we'll come back and...